This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is a good theme song, right?
Do we start?
Yeah.
I got okay. Find
those two right. In the sand. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ooh.
Yes.
Is this the theme song of our show or the theme song of their show?
This is the theme song of our show.
Sweet.
I think so. I mean, it was in the pilot, obviously, when she was doing her montage of walking down the street.
Yeah. Wait, what are we talking about?
This is marvelous. The marvelous,
Mrs.
the amazing Miss Maisel.
Guys, the amazing...
Welcome back. Or if it's your first time. No.
Okay.
No, we'll do it. This
You're
is
just
raw.
Tuning in.
People like a rock. Welcome to the marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goys. I'm Kevin.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Maisel Goys. Are we cute?
Are we cute or
we're
what?
A little cute, right?
Put us in your pocket.
Hey,
take us to the market. Spend some money.
Market.
Don't forget we're in there.
Funny. Folks.
Oh, boy.
It's episode two. It's our first episode with a guest who we will not introduced quite yet.
Wow.
Alice, we're talking
You're
about
You're going to want to pull over for this.
You are. Get out of your car. Do a fire drill. Run around.
Put your head between your legs. Breathe.
Kiss your tuckers goodbye. It's the marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goys. A two-time Golden Globe winning show.
Oh my God.
As
we're
of
back.
Recording this. How about that?
Yeah. Oh my God. How time's up. About that. Time's
you
up.
You think that was a time's up win?
It was a time's up win.
From Amazon Prime?
Completely. Yeah. It was, you know, time was up.
The cognitive dissonance of seeing Amy Sherman-Palladino accept an award for anything was pretty wild. She doesn't. I don't know if that's her, like, main natural habitat. Right. Her acceptance speech included...
You know what? I didn't see it.
And Rachel Brosnahan, half-human, half-Tolkien character, we thank you. We love you. I'm going backstage. Is there cheese backstage? Let's go backstage. Bye.
Are you serious?
That was what she ended with. Yeah. I'm going to go find some cheese backstage.
Amazing.
Hashtag.
She's unable to be anything but herself.
It's a marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goys. We recorded the first episode many weeks ago.
Oh, many weeks.
Like 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Many moons.
Now we're back on our bullshit.
Yeah.
Bomb. B-O-M-B.
B-O-M-B.
And we're very current with it. We're recording this 48 hours before we're putting it out.
Ooh.
Riding that wave.
I'm in a good mood that's going to stretch till Monday.
I think so. And as of recording this, I have seen the entire series now.
Oh.
The entire first series. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Much clapter.
You did it. So we have a lot to talk about.
We have a lot to talk about.
But we're not going to talk about all of it on this one episode and then stop doing these.
No! That'd be blowing our Maisel wads.
What? God damn it. Should we do the correction section before the guest? Because the guest won't have any reason to. Well, she can correct us, too.
Do you want to do a I think the guest can correct us, too.
Yeah.
Let's get her in the mix.
Okay.
Come on.
All right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, she is a stand-up. She is an actress. She is a writer. You may know her from Girl Code, or you can see her on Crashing now on HBO. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Jamie Lee.
I just introduced myself a little bit.
Clapping.
Jamie.
Hi. So good to be here.
Thanks for joining us on the show.
Jamie, you are the best person for the job.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
There isn't a person I'd rather have for this.
Do you want to take over for me?
Yeah, and that's kind of what this...
This is Kevin, why we brought you here.
It's
a guest host swap, right?
So, Jamie and I have known each other for how many eons?
Like, I don't know how long eons. Yes, 10
like,
years.
Like, I would say 10 years, right?
10 eons.
And we started stand-up. I started stand-up a little bit after you, and or maybe a lot after you.
I don't know.
You were. I remember looking up
I
to
was
you.
So. Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
You were slightly taller, so.
Oh.
This is true.
Slightly
and, I am physically taller.
And you, I met you through our buddy Sean Perlman,
yes.
who we're still miraculously friends with.
I
Are you
know.
Still friends with him?
I love him.
Is that a miracle?
Yeah. It Is it?
It's a marvelous
miracle. I don't know. It kind of is a miracle, right?
No, you're just saying not. To be friends with anybody for that long a time.
I guess so.
Not because Sean's a particularly difficult man.
No.
He's really sweetie peety. He's really, yeah.
He's the sweetest.
Yeah. Now, Jamie.
Yes.
You're into this show.
I'm so into it.
Independent of us reaching out, you posted on your IG, hey, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, into it. Love it.
Love it. Posted a picture with, or not with, I wasn't with Rachel, Brosnahan, right? Is that the
Brosnahan.
But I posted a picture of her and then just like gave her an extra long shout out. And then she responded.
Yes.
Which was like so lovely.
Apparently
we have a bit of a mutual friend, a girl that I worked with on this web series that I did many moons ago. She is her best friend. She's Rachel's best friend.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So we had like a little Instagram connection there. Mm. But yeah.
Was she mean about it?
She was so mean.
Was she mean about it?
She was like,
it?
I hate this photo. You could have chosen any other photo.
Why don't you stick your nose where it doesn't belong? Super bitchy.
But yeah. So anyways, yes, I'm obsessed with the show. I think it's like incredible.
Did you binge it? Did you like watch it on a couple of sittings? Or was it a slow burn?
I did like somewhere in the middle because there are hour long episodes.
Yeah.
So I couldn't go one or the other into the other
sure.
for too long. But I did, I think, in one night watch like two back to back, which is, you know, essentially the length of a movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I think I watched the whole thing in like a week.
And for you, what do you think is like the strongest point of connection?
You okay.
Oh, yeah. The strongest point. That's just a vocal tick. My throat's fine.
Wow. I love you to just do subtle warm-ups throughout the show.
Strong. Like the strongest point of connection for
the show.
The strongest point of connection, I don't know. I've actually like tried to articulate it. I think that I feel sort of shocked by the fact that whatever little experiences,
it's already hard.
I'm already undermining. Mm-hmm. It is very hard.
Right? It's like talking
it is
about
so hard
when you do LSD or something.
I don't know what.
Okay.
I don't know.
I'm
why
saying it's
I
hard
had
for
such a
me
hard
to
time.
Describe when you do LSD.
Oh yes.
Like,
well,
I haven't heard from her.
Oh, no.
I'm over here being a snake. I don't know. I think that the thing that I connect with is hard for me to articulate because I can't really say I connect to her exact experience. Being a woman in stand-up in the late 1950s, but there are moments where I'm like, oh, even though that was a long time ago, it still feels really current, which is insane. And I don't, you know what I mean?
And I wonder, sometimes I'm like, well, that's because it's written in modernity and that's what we do is try to connect those like universal stories and everything.
Right.
But sometimes I'm like, maybe it's because the plight of being a woman hasn't really changed that much since like 1904, you know, or like 1920 when we got the vote. Like it's pretty much been the same, like in a lot of ways. Like the sexual revolution definitely like changed things, but there's like this idea of like what a woman is supposed to be that Midge is striving for.
Right.
And she gets and she nails and then it like all falls apart and then she turns to stand up. And I think as a woman doing stand up, it's like you feel that release of like, oh, okay, I can be like truly myself here.
Yeah. I also love how she doesn't really know how to do stand up, but she also does have an inherent ability to do it. Like she doesn't know how to necessarily, or I mean, she wrote some jokes for her husband. So I feel like she does have a writing ability, but then when she actually goes on stage alone by herself, I feel like she kind of just wings it and like she's very raw.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, her manager's like, oh, you were incredible. You have such a natural ability. And she's like, I don't even know what that was. Like she's kind of in a fugue state.
Yeah.
But then when she was helping her husband, it was very much like, here are some jokes that you should try.
Yeah.
And she hasn't connected the two. And there's something really like intriguing to me just about that.
Yeah.
The idea that it is an overflow of a presence that's always been within her.
Yes.
And that she kind of, I mean, she essentially falls ass backwards into it.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Do you feel like you guys connect with the idea where it's like, oh, this was not my North Star for like, I got to be a stand-up baby from the time you were like a 12-year-old girl. But it's just what you happen to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
we've talked about this before a little bit because it is like that for me. But what about you?
How so? Like, what do you mean by like you feel like the pieces kind of just were eventually put
totally
together? That's how it was
together.
For me too.
Yeah, I just was. I didn't grow up. I grew up listening to stand up to a certain extent. And I had my like comedy idols, like you know Wayne and Garth and everything, and I was like, into all of that.
Same.
But I didn't. Same. But like same. I didn't.
want to be a stand-up. And even when I started like improv, it didn't occur to me. And then suddenly it just like was like, I'd like to try that. And then the first time I did it, I was like, okay, this is there. That was like the floodgates opened. And I was like, I'm never not doing this. I'm just going to do it all the time.
Yeah. I feel like you always hear that narrative of like, you know, like, oh, your parents were trying to put you to bed when you were 8 years old.
Yes.
And you're like, ah, but I would stay up and I would hide under the covers and watch Letterman.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
You're like, that was
or
never.
I had to put on the new, like, whatever,
yeah.
Rickles.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Whatever, you know, people just.
Did you guys like Don Rickles growing up?
Rickles.
As anything but Mr. Potato
no.
Head?
No, but like that's the like,
you
was,
hear it, and then
like with us with our age group, it's like Bill Hicks or whatever.
Yeah,
you know?
But no, when you said yeah, Wayne and Garth, that was huge.
Yeah.
I don't think I knew it was huge at the time. Also, Steve Martin and Father of the Bride, because that made Steve Martin a little more like accessible to like a different audience, and it was like that was a movie for women. I went and saw it with
my
aunt.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, and then in college, maybe end of high school, I got really into David Cross.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit before that, I got really into Margaret Cho. Those were like my two that I kind of
That's way earlier than me.
She came to Dallas when I was like 13 years old, and I went to see her with my mom. And then I saw her every time she came back.
Yeah.
I didn't even know other comedians. I thought it was just Margaret Cho.
That's exactly, yeah. Like you don't, like I thought of comedy as like until literally probably in college, like late college, maybe even post college, I saw Silverman and then I was like, that changed everything. When I saw Sarah Silverman live, I was like, holy shit. I had no idea that that was out there.
You
that
saw you could her in be, New York?
I saw her in New York. Oh. And I mean, I was like probably 24, 23. And I didn't know that that was, could be a thing. And then I got a little bit, I did, but then I dipped in and out and it was like that. I was like, I didn't, it wasn't into stand up because of her. I was like, I was into her. Like, she's great. Oh, she's amazing.
Yeah. Same.
You know? And then I saw somebody put on Chris Rock, like one of his specials one time when I was like doing a fuck ton of coke. And I was like, oh my God, like that's another, that peeled off another layer of the onion where I was like, I had no idea stand-up could be this, you know, and I found that really inspiring.
Be like that in the sense of like dangerous feeling or just speaking to particular things,
yeah. Like super culturally, like his stand-up and Sarah in a way too, but like Chris is so brave the way he like not like brave hashtag me too brave, but like
Meridia brave,
he's just courageous and like he is completely confident in himself in this, like he's extremely aggressive towards the audience but not in a way where he's doing dumb comedy. Like a lot of aggressive comedy is club comedy and it's like, hey, you know,
fuck you.
Or like Dane Cook, or like Chris is like just like he's has
specific.
The audience like in his palm and he's like he's a giant in a way even though he's not tall. Anyway, you get it. And it just kind of blew my mind. And then like I did. And then again, I like stopped thinking about it for 5 years.
Yeah.
And then finally, when I was like 27, 28 or something like that, I like took an improv class and I met Sean. That's how I got.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wait, you were in the same improv class?
I was in the same improv class, 201 with Sean, and he obviously wanted to, you know, date me. And and
just
so
gloss over that.
No, and I found out that he and a couple other people in the class did stand up and I was like, I'd like to try that. And it was like literally like converting to Judaism.
Yeah.
Because I was like, I'd like to try stand up and he's like, oh yeah, totally, totally. And then I like saw him again and I was like, no, I want to come with you to an open mic. And he's like, yeah, tell me when. We'll do it. And I'm like, tomorrow. And he's like, sure, I'll get in touch. And then like finally a third time I was like, Sean, I got to do this. You need to let me. And
Sean
he was like,
Perlman
okay, we'll
was
go.
Your Lenny Bruce.
He was my Lenny Bruce.
Ooh.
Yeah. And then, of course, Sean loves to talk about stand-up, so it was perfect. Oh. He's just like, okay, here's what you need to know. Here's Wendy Liebman. Like, here's...
Yeah. Oh. So he, like, shepherded you. Yeah, because also at that time, the improv scene and the comedy scene, they felt very separate.
Mm-hmm.
There was almost, like, a weird rivalry or something. Mm-hmm. I feel like now it's a little more integrated because like a lot of people from the improv world crossed over and embraced stand up. It should have always been integrated, but for some reason back then I feel like they were in New York especially. I can't speak for other cities, but in New York they're very, very separate. It was like you either do improv or you do stand up, and sometimes stand ups would take improv only to help their stand up.
Yeah.
Like it never felt like they were interested in like crossing over to the improv world.
I think for a while, like when I got into improv, I was frustrated because improv became something that ironically, was not just for fun, and it was about becoming a professional comedian on Saturday Night Live or whatever. Like, because suddenly every comedy thing was like populated with people that were UCB people. Like, all of a sudden, every commercial, every like sketch show was all UCB people. And so it was like, oh, stand up isn't even a path anymore. You have to be doing improv at UCB. And then that, I think, made stand up just a resentful situation. Like, people were like, because I remember fighting with Sean, and I was like, yeah, this. I'm taking UCB classes so I can like have a job. And he's like, that's not, you don't make money at improv. And I was like, yeah, you do. Like, look at who's on SNL. And he was like, no, no. And now it's so funny, like years later, and I'm like, yeah, I would never make money doing improv. Like, it's crazy. Like,
and you never will. And I want listeners to take that lesson
just
away.
Just understand that.
From
you
the
will
show today.
You will lose money. You will lose money.
Guys, let's get into the episode.
Let's do it.
This is episode 2. The title is...
That's Russian, motherfucker.
So that subtitle. That last part isn't in the title
in
on
the
Amazon.
Title.
But the Amazon synopsis is, Midge's life is in a tailspin in the wake of Joel leaving. Midge and Joel's parents butt heads while trying to keep their family together. Susie pushes Midge to get back on stage and find her voice. Susie's the one pushing. And I think we should get into a segment that I think we're officially going to call
12 o'clock rock, we're gonna
pop
around
the culture
tonight.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
You did it. You did it.
We did it.
Kevin hasn't slept in 2 weeks.
That's true.
Works hard.
Not from working, just from nervousness about playing that clip in front of two people I respect.
I loved that so much.
Oh, there's two people you respect here? Are they hiding?
No, come on.
Hello.
I have all the respect in the world for both of you.
Challenge accepted.
This is the segment in which we take every pop culture reference in the episode and put them in a supercut. Spoiler alert, this is the shortest one I've ever done for an Amy Sherman Palladino show.
Wow.
This is 4 references. Here we go. 102.
Rochester probably loved that first wife of his, and then she went nuts and burned the house down.
I had no idea you were related to fucking Charlemagne.
She wanted to play and run around dressed in black like a Fellini film.
She's gonna do what with her life? Sit around all day long eating bonbons, watching Queen for a day.
That's it.
Oh, wow. God.
That's it.
I wonder if that's why I liked this episode so much.
Well, I mean, it's like...
No,
what
I don't hate the references, though, so that doesn't make sense.
Wait, do you usually hate the references?
No, I'm just said, like, I don't, that's not a thing for me, so I don't know why I said
that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. We'll edit that out.
But maybe the lack of references allows for more screen time for something else. Yeah, for some stunts.
Substance.
I thought you said stunts.
That's when stunts feel really earned.
It's like you can be one kind of writer in this town. You can be about substance. Or you can just be about some stunts. And you got to choose which one you're going to be.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the choice we all have
to
make.
We all have to make.
But that's it. That's 4.
Yeah.
The first one was a Jane Eyre reference. Air.
Jane Eyre.
Jane Eyre. I knew I was going to miss.
I liked it. It was phonetic.
Thank you.
That's good. That's the way it looks.
Good job.
And then Queen for a Day. Charlemagne, which is iffy as a pop culture reference.
Well, how did they know about Charlemagne the God?
Back then. They knew.
To me,
they knew it was a comic.
Anachronistic.
That is a little bit of a world.
That's a goof. I give that a, you know what? We should address this.
He has a new book out.
We should address this. In the last episode, for things that we liked, we gave an amazel tov.
Tov.
Which should be tov.
We were saying it wrong.
Yep, we were saying it wrong.
Amazel tov.
But we said Yom Kippur last time, which I think struck at least some of our listeners as insensitive.
Can I read text thread about this?
Wait, what happened?
Well, it's a very sacred holiday.
Yes.
And even though we're not making live the holiday and it is just wordplay, we don't want to do anything that would be misconstrued as insensitive to another person's faith.
Yes.
So I think we may modify it from a Yom Kippur to, if I may... And I'll throw this out to the group for approval or disapproval. A schlemazel.
Ooh.
Is that all right?
I'm not the person to say.
I don't know what
so schlemazel,
uh-huh.
I believe, is a Yiddish word meaning like something negative.
Okay.
But it feels a little less sacred
than... Yes, totally.
Yom Kippur.
Than a holiday. Right. Yeah. Okay,
so
okay,
I'm going to do a dramatic reading right now.
This is
us deciding to change it.
Yep.
Our text thread... I'll be playing both roles, Kevin, and I will disguise my voice when I'm Kevin, and I'll be, you know, me, my normal voice. So, this is Kevin.
We've gotten like six or
gosh.
So oh, wow. like just basic.
We've gotten like six or seven Jewish people saying Yom Kippur is an offensive pun.
Sounds so like a bad Aaron Paul maybe, impression.
Maybe we should change it.
No. Deal breaker. JK.
What an odd hill to die upon. But I respect you.
I did say that.
Maybe our fans should be called snowflakes. That's the end of that.
That's
so
the end
you're
of
welcome.
That.
I thought that was going to be way better than it was. That's okay.
No, no, it was good.
It was good.
I give up.
What? Already?
Don't quit.
We're not
Al.
Even the fourth end of
You have so much more to give.
Thank you.
Now, Jamie, you are. One of the.
Married.
Chosen.
Married. Right?
Mary.
I'm married.
You're married and you're Jewish.
And I'm Jewish. Yes.
And you're married,
and I'm married
to a Jewish
to
person.
A Jewish
into
person.
A Jewish situation.
Yes. I am in a.
Oh my God. He's like the Jewish situation.
He is. Oh my God.
That was his nickname in college.
Wow. That's very accurate.
Now, how did. I will ask as our first guest, our first Jewish guest, how did the portrayal of the Jewish faith and culture and customs on this show
yes.
differ or reflect your own growing up?
I grew up not religious. Mm-hmm. On my mother's side, I am Jewish, but I did not grow up celebrating really anything. And then when I moved to New York, I was living closer to my aunt and uncle who are conservative Jews, mm-hmm. and I would spend Jewish holidays with them because they were my family that lived closest to me. And so I feel like I became a little more aware of like Jewish holidays and Jewish traditions through them. And then when I met my husband, Dan, I sort of, that was even more emphasized.
Sure.
So I'm still learning. I'm not a great Jew. I just want to put that out there.
But
not,
Dan is, right?
Dan so is
shout
top,
out Dan Black.
Top notch. He's
a very
from
funny
Long
comedian.
Island. Lot of,
yeah.
A real big community there.
Yep.
And I've since been immersed yes. in
tell
their
you
ways.
Something that you told me.
Yes.
When you first started dating Dan.
Yes.
You said, I can't do this anymore. I'm just kidding.
Whoa. Oh, no. This is going to be so hurtful.
Whoa. What did I say? Oh, did you ever? Oh.
I'm going to sow wild oats and not tell him. That's what you said. No. You said, I remember you talking about like how much of the, how immersed they were in Jewish culture.
Yes.
And like how many, you know, and you were just like, it's overwhelming. There's so much.
There is.
Like you just were like, I didn't even know.
Like, yeah, I didn't know.
I remember being like, I didn't even know that people did all these things.
Yeah.
And it was kind of exciting.
Well, it's also
for me to hear about.
Well, it's weird when, because I think like you, like, I don't know, for some reason, my mom never really, she didn't have the pride that most Jewish people I meet are vocal about it. And they're excited and they're like, oh, like, let's connect over this. And my mom was so not that person. Mm-hmm. I don't know if she's like rebelling or I really don't know what it is.
Sure.
Well, but she grew up in Texas.
I grew up in Texas and
it's
maybe
not,
like, maybe she downplayed it because of that. I mean, I definitely met a lot of Jewish people in Texas.
Yeah.
So, but I think it was just that she wasn't raised, like my grandmother was not very religious, but like I think they pursued the religious part because the community did that. I don't
yeah.
think because they really felt it. I think that
yeah.
they were just trying to like, you know, keep up.
Yeah.
So yeah, and maybe that's where it stems from. I'm not sure.
That probably functions in a way that like a lot of, at least in my experience from my own religion, cultural Christianity works, where it's mm-hmm. like it's easy to do once you're growing up to just kind of commit to the surface level things like
yeah.
you go to church on Christmas Eve
yep.
or Easter Sunday and you go to synagogue for, you know, the similarly, you mm-hmm. know, big events
right.
or
yeah,
whatever the case
yeah.
may be.
Yeah.
But then it's
or
a hard
go to
thing.
The tide pools for
you go to
solstice
the tide pools for solstice. Yeah.
New moon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're a witch, right?
We don't call ourselves witches.
Spoiler alert.
We are druids.
And we, you know, I was really encouraged by the number of Jewish listeners that we heard from
mm-hmm.
after the first episode, because there was a lot of people speaking to different parts of it, where it was like the timeline of these two episodes, the pilot and
yeah.
the second episode, when Yom Kippur takes place is strange and it's kind of hard to follow. And
that's really cool. I love our fans so much, and I really want to say thank you guys for reaching out about the Yom Kippur thing, because we don't know what we're doing and we need your help, and you guys are educating us, and it's for free, so thank you very much. And the rest of you who are pretending to be Jewish and you're just Russian bots, we're going to find out.
Well, I don't think we have any of those.
Well, some of them are.
I do want to read something that Jordana sent in. She sent a very long and lovely email to us and said, the Sherman Palladinos created their experience with Jewish America from New York City in the 1950s. Like Gilmore Girls, we have to suspend some of the reality. This is not a perfect historically researched piece. It's a fever dream sequence of Amy Sherman Palladino's love of her father, comedy, strong female relationships, and hats. Set to the music and styling of her parents, this is ASP perfecting the disaster that was the fever dream in A Year in the Life, that was the final Life and Death Brigade trip. It's a beautiful tribute, but it's not a solid representation. Mm. So that's how it struck Jordana. It might strike you differently, but that's at least a little bit of perspective for the show.
I almost
show.
Feel like that comes across. I mean, it's sort of a stylized.
Yeah.
You know, you can. Amy Sherman is like a testament to the fact that you can have really solid, fleshed out, grounded characters in a super stylized, heightened reality.
I've never thought once while watching The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, is this a documentary?
Yeah. No.
And you know what? One thing I do appreciate that I think is fun to play fast and loose with, and I think we will like compare and contrast a lot with Mad Men, but Mad Men, you hear stories of Matt Weiner. Being a little like anal retentive about the period, if every detail isn't right in the frame and we're in 1956 and there's something from 1957, well, we got to reshoot the whole blah, 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 blah.
Someone's going to know.
Yeah. Whereas with this and the previous episode, it ends with songs written in the 80s, I believe.
Right.
70s and 80s. So I do appreciate the looseness.
Kind of like Dirty Dancing.
Yeah.
Where it's supposed to be the 60s, but like, you know, Hungry Eyes is
but
like
everyone
the most
has 80s hair.
Yeah.
There's an actress in that movie I really enjoy.
Kevin's Perv Corner. Kevin's
no,
Perv Corner.
No, come on. No.
Kevin's Perv Corner.
I don't
want to
do
corner.
That. No.
He's a perv.
No. Shouts out to, of course, Miss Kelly Bishop. Who plays Jennifer Grey's mom in that movie.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, she was great.
So, first episode they make, after the pilot gets picked up, they go to series,
that's
picks
right.
up right where the last one leaves off. Lenny Bruce is giving her the business.
I was almost
about,
confused by
there
that.
There was a little bit of a repetition, wasn't there? They did a slight recap, I feel like.
It confused my dumb little brain.
confused
I have an acorn-sized brain, so I was like, you know.
It's
just kind
of... Yeah, but it picks up with that. Lenny Bruce is telling her, oh, get a lawyer. You're going to have to go to court, blah, 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 da-da-da. And then Midge sees New York for, I think, what most of us think New York to be now.
Yeah,
and it's set to that amazing song by the Barry Sisters. You know that song?
Let's hear it.
It's called Vyok Tyok Tyok, which I'm sure I'm mispronouncing.
Is it French?
No, it's Yiddish.
Oh!
So... The Barry Sisters, this is an interesting thing. This is a fun thing. Guys, you ready for this? You ready for this? In an interview about the music in this show, Amy and Dan went on record saying the time frame allowed us to discover so many interesting artists. We discovered the Barry Sisters, who we're listening to right now, who were sort of the Andrew Sisters of the Jewish set. We used a couple of their songs, which are unbelievable songs. They have a forceful musicality to them, which we got to experience because we're dealing with a 1958 Jewish family. And that's a group they would know. I didn't even know about them until I wandered into Amoeba Music and saw a used vinyl that features
them. Holy shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
Imagining ASP wandering into Amoeba. Oh, yes, please.
I know. That's everything.
Like, I can't get around
to it. It's literally like my biggest fantasy.
I want to grab.
He's bumping into Amy Sherman Palladino at Amoeba.
No, just even knowing, like, just imagining her there. I don't even have to run into her.
I
want to
grab the new War on Drugs and Kurt Vile on vinyl, but I can't get around this woman's giant Muppety.
Excuse
hat.
Me.
You get like poked in the eye with a feather. You're like, this is everything.
There's a beautiful Babadook in front of me and I can't see the section.
Babadook! Oh my god.
She's
a
beautiful
it.
Babadook,
she
guys.
She is. That's so perfect.
She's glowed up Babadook and we all need to accept that.
Oh my god. Babadook.
Wow. Yes.
Just the slightest change.
That's what Dan
bit of a
said.
Babadook.
That's what Dan said at the altar, you guys. He said, I Babadook.
I Babadook.
I Babadook.
I do.
I find the okay.
Oh,
I find
wow.
the soundtrack start to finish in this show exceptional.
Exceptional.
You can
love
find
it.
Every song in this show on our Marvelous Mrs. Maisel soundtrack playlist on Spotify.
That you made?
That I made, yeah. Oh, I made it. I made it when we did the very first episode on Gilmore, like back in March. Right. But then I updated it for the rest of the season.
Okay, all right.
And it is
I
like...
I want you to do something special for me, though, before this is over.
What's that?
I don't know. Something.
Okay.
You figure it out.
I feel like doing this show
with
you...
Gotta be the right thing or else I'm disappointed.
Wait, do you want to exchange gifts in the finale?
Maybe.
Okay. But it seems that every turn in this show, one thing that happens a lot, I feel like, in pilots is... They want to wow you. They want to impress you. They want to impress the network so they can get picked up. So they splurge a lot on whatever it is. If it's a sci-fi show, they splurge on effects and action sequences, or they splurge on locations or costuming, or like they just use up so much budget.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the show is like, nah, let's do a lot of this inside.
And this,
is not the case.
The polar opposite.
With this show. The Garment District alone.
I mean,
when we meet Joel's father.
Oh my God, it was so insane.
It was so insane. That was, I was just saying, I was actually just talking to Dan about this on the way here. I was like, the budget for that shot alone.
I know.
Was.
Just for him to walk
because
through.
It's costumes crossing, but you look, it goes so far back. It's not like they scaled it to where it's like, let's make this look like it's the whole street. It actually was the whole street.
Yeah.
And the fact is, because there was duplicates of a dress, and they all are new dresses.
Right.
These aren't dead stock. Like, they
There's
had to
no way.
Sew from scratch all of the dresses just hanging on all the racks, inside and outside the warehouse and the street.
Yeah.
So that's, like, hundreds and upon hundreds of dresses that are just props that are just flying by. That's
it was
crazy.
Like a, it was like a musical.
It was amazing.
1,000%.
It was unreal.
This show is in so many ways a musical.
Yeah.
And that, like, that shot, it's a little Goodfellas-y because it's, like, a long Steadicam, and then he goes into the...
Yeah.
Didn't you love how he, like... His like the way he walks is almost like a musical. Like he was walking forward, then he like turned back.
Yep.
He like walked backwards. Yeah, he did a lot of like sidestepping.
Like a lot of spins.
Yeah.
He did a pirouette.
Yeah, at any moment. Yeah.
Into the factory. And it is something where it's like, this has no story purpose at all. Like from a functional story perspective, it's like, we don't need to see the street. You could just cut to it.
Absolutely.
Then he goes into his office. It's just Amy and Dan being like, yo, we got some money.
Yo, we got some money. And what would the Garment District look like in the 50s? Of course, I mean, I've walked down those streets a million times. Used to live there, lived there for a long time. And I always wanted to know something about it. What do the floral district look like in the 50s? I mean, amazing.
It was
I bet
stunning.
It was so like, hey, flowers, you know?
It was so
stunning.
It felt
like Muppets Take Manhattan or something.
Yeah.
I see Joel as like a rejected Muppet of
a little
of a sort.
Bit. A little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, I feel like he's good at playing period because he was on Boardwalk Empire for a few years, too.
Wasn't he on Girls?
He might
have. Oh, yeah, that's right.
That's where I remember him from. I
Interesting.
Was like, his face looks familiar. Yeah. But yeah.
So he knows those streets.
I also actually was at an audition with him once, and I didn't know it was him at the time, but now I'm like, that was the guy from the waiting room because it was just the two of us sitting there, and we weren't even talking, but I just, he has a very distinct face.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, was he mean?
No.
He mean is the question.
He was dressed, I do remember he was dressed very like indie rock.
Oh boy.
So, which means this is even more, this character's even more of a stretch for him.
He's going to get two scarves in season two, I guarantee.
Like a neckerchief scarf and another, and like he's riding a fixed gear.
This is the episode in which we meet Moesha Mazel and Shirley Mazel.
Yep.
It was played by Kevin Pollak and the great Caroline Aaron, who I find to be very funny in everything she's in.
Oh, she's
so
real good.
Excellent.
But Kevin Pollak, it feels like home for him to be playing this this sort of character. I found him, like, he's not a guy for whom I've said, oh shit, Pollak's in this? I gotta see it. But I found this to be one of his best performances, maybe since A Few Good Men.
Ha! I was right. I mean, I wasn't sure at first. I heard that name, Penny Pan, and I thought, well, that's a stupid name, but I took a shot and I was right.
That is my job.
I love being right.
That's a statement to make, but I agree. It feels like the one of those things where, and I love this about this show, so many of the portrayals, it's like, is this person showing up to set and going through makeup, or did we bring a set to this person who was already doing that thing? You know what I mean?
They like, just
he's
found
just
them in the
in
wild.
There doing that.
Yeah.
Like it's so natural, which is weird for ASP.
Yeah. And it was a perfect casting choice in the sense of his energy.
Yeah.
And I believe Pollock's inherent energy would create a Joel type person.
Yeah. Yes.
If
it's very believable. Yes.
Yeah.
It's very believable. That Joel is a little bit, like, he's a little more reserved, and you can tell why. It's because, like, I feel like his parents sort of steamroll any situation, so he sort of, like, holds court a little bit.
Yeah. Also,
I auditioned for it.
Yeah, you audition as Moishe Mason.
They wanted to go with an older man, and I was like, that makes sense, you know.
Did either of you audition for Mrs. Maisel?
I did.
You did?
I did. Yeah, I auditioned for Midge.
Really?
Well, did you?
I couldn't because of POE.
Oh.
I wanted to audition for recurring, but there wasn't anything.
Wait, so your audition, was that...
I felt good about it. Yeah. I mean, it was from the pilot, the speech that she gives at the wedding. That was the audition. Wow.
Who gives a toast at her own wedding?
Yeah.
I do, that mm-hmm. one.
And it's interesting because the way that she played it, in my head, I was like, that's what I sounded like. I really did feel like it
Rachel's
was
ripping me off.
but it was written to sound, you know, the writing is so, it's such a testament to the writing. The writing is so good that is exactly how you want to deliver.
Yeah. Right.
So I feel like everyone's auditions were like, you know, in that vein.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I did what she did, but it was similar for
that's
sure.
That's funny. I know there was some audition tape that surfaced on, I think I saw it on Vimeo or something, where it was the scene was the breakup scene.
Oh, that was also Joel. That was the other one. So it was those two.
It was those two. Yeah. Okay,
wow.
Gotcha.
Ooh, yeah. I gotta go down a wormhole looking for that.
I never watch those tapes. I always wish it.
I hope we find out that all of our guests auditioned for Midge.
So many people auditioned for Midge.
Yeah.
I know Megan Amram auditioned
she
for
did?
Midge. I believe so.
Love that. Love that.
Jason Mendoza did.
Jason Mendoza auditioned for Midge Maisel.
That was a strange thing. Just like it was like an open call.
They're like, why not? After a year in the life, they were like, this guy can handle our dialogue.
He's a fan.
Yeah. So, also in the beginning of this, you see Midge return to the diner that her and Joel went to after their wedding, where they touchingly had sex in the bathroom.
Yeah, I actually thought about that. I was like, do you think they had sex in there? Do you think they were doing something that was just like a little risque for the time?
Like meth?
Like, do you think they just like had a hard makeout? Or so? I don't know.
I don't think so. I think that
I thought it was sex, but then I was like, oh, it could have also just been anything, because I think doing anything in the bathroom is taboo.
I also think it might have been a blowy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But she said the clock's starting or something like that at the beginning. So I took that to mean, maybe.
The clock starting as in that's from the time I said to come in.
Gotcha. Yeah. But I really liked how that scene was blocked. Mm-hmm. Music of that. And kind of, it was almost theatrical the way like the camera panned over from him closing the door to her in present day in the same shot. I thought was really elegant blocking.
Mm-hmm. All the flashbacks. Oh, no, go ahead.
Yeah, flashbacks.
All the flashbacks are so, they're so and good.
And that left it such a hollow feeling when it came back to reality and her memory of it. And, you know, the pan over and then pan back and it's just her by herself. And then like the waitress, of course, you know, are you alone? Which is like, you know.
Yes, she is. Whew. And there's a key line.
On so many levels.
In that flashback, I feel like, where Joel says,
thought I married a nice girl.
Oh, you did not.
There was also that moment where she goes, do you love me? And he didn't answer it right away.
Mm-hmm.
And then she says it, and she asks again, and then he kind of like takes a moment, and he's very casual with it, and he's like,
do you?
I do.
And you're just like, I don't know, it was very hot.
It was hot. It was hot.
He's Joel's so hot.
We think he's hot.
You guys are both turned on by Joel.
I like him a lot and I want his body.
I want both of them.
Lenny Bruce.
Oh my God. You guys like Lenny Bruce?
I love him.
Yeah, Lenny Bruce is hot too. Oh,
I find him to be more sexually energetic than Joel.
Really?
That's just my personal taste.
Joel is...
You get it.
Oh my God, he's got something going on. Joel is so hot.
Yeah.
Do you feel like there's an attraction because you feel like you'd be funnier than him?
What? No, of course I'm funnier than him. But also, that's not what the attraction's about. I just like the character is so, it's such a real dude. And it's
such a real dude.
Yeah, and he's got his like certain things that he knows how to romance a girl. And then once he's in it, he doesn't really know what to do. And it's like, that is so real.
And he's conflicted and he doesn't have he has his shit together, but emotionally, because he has his shit together, he is actually falling apart.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is so real.
I mean, and I continue to stare the fact in the face that I am afraid that I might be a Joel type.
Why is
in
that
my
bad?
Own life. Why is that bad?
It's not like the devil.
My husband also said something similar.
Really?
I think that Joel is striking a chord with guys.
I think so. It touches upon an insecurity for me.
Yeah, Dan said something about, I don't even remember, but he was just like, there was a feeling about Joel where he was like, I don't know.
What's the insecurity? I don't get it.
I think the ineptitude, and especially standing next to a woman who is not saying physically attractive, but attractive in such like personality and vibrance in that way, and just thinking you come up short.
Well,
and
who especially cares if you come up short?
Well, in the sense of,
I mean,
not in the sense of like she's better at me in these things and I admire her, but I'm not better at her than anything.
Let me say
but
that. Okay.
I was just going to say in the sense that, what? Are you mad?
Always. Okay. Slightly.
But just in the sense of like, oh, I don't think I'd be worthy of that. Or just like, I think the insecurity that a lot of men feel sometimes when like, oh, I'm dating a person with like this amazing job or has this amazing career, or it's just like good with people in a way that I'm not, where I think there's complimentary things that work sometimes. But then there's like, oh, I don't like the kind of Instagram caption cliche of I don't deserve her is like, no, I literally don't deserve her. And I think it's like a crime that I would be with her because she would deserve more.
Yeah, but that's like me. Can I just jump in here?
Sure.
And this is for our listeners too. That... First of all, that idea of like yourself is unworthy because the woman is like better than you or more amazing somehow is like what all that does is puts you in a box of like your ego telling you something, and you're just like subscribing to this notion of like, look, the best that you can be is showing up for somebody even though they are so impressive to you that you feel insignificant. That's actually the bravest choice that you could possibly make. You'd be more of a man if you could do that. And so many men can't do that. And it pisses me off because it's like, hey, welcome to being a woman. We've taken a back seat and we've been the second in command and we've been the fucking, you know, back person, woman behind the man for fucking decades. And it's time for men to start showing up and being like, I will be the less important person and I will be not the star of the show and it won't destroy me because it really doesn't need to destroy you because it's actually like, I don't know, like I've had this experience so many times and it's like you're more of a man if you're able to deal with the fact that you're not the person
in a secure
the star
way.
Of the show all the time because then you become the star of the show. You become the star of my show. If you're that guy, you know, if you can show up and be like, oh my God, I'm just here to like witness you. It's like, okay, then you are the person I respect the most in the entire world.
Right.
You know?
Oh yeah. And I don't mean that.
I loved that.
No, that's really great. And I actually agree with all that. I would be fine being someone's Rita again. Wilson for the rest of my life. I would be more than fine if that's what we're talking about.
We all want to be Rita.
No nagging on Rita Wilson, who's amazing in her own right.
Incredible.
Of course. But just in the sense of like, I think character-wise, not like, I deserve and want more attention, and that's what males should get. But just in those things.
Oh, I know that it's not coming from a male entitlement place. It's like a human reaction to a situation.
Well, I think it's also what makes Joel such a strong, sympathetic character is that he is grappling with insecurity, but he oozes, I know it's wrong. He doesn't seem like
is almost like unrealistic for the time period.
I know.
And which is why he's such a gem. Yeah.
He's such a gem. And it just makes him even hotter.
I love how so Team Joel hot. We are in the room.
We're the super hottest. Team Joel.
That's great. And and I think maybe those, from a male perspective, maybe those points of connection I feel is why it's not like, well, this guy's a dumb whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
I
he's
don't
not
care
the guy from
him.
The Crown.
I haven't seen The Crown.
It. Oh my God, you haven't seen The Crown?
No.
I had to stop watching it because I like literally don't know why it matters. Everything's like, The Crown, it's over there and it's supposed to be over there. And everybody like loses their mind for half an episode.
What
this guy wants to be in the over here when we say a thing.
I haven't seen it, but I feel
dumb.
Like you're summing it
I
up
I feel
perfectly.
Like I've seen it now.
Now I've seen it. Shit.
What did you guys make of the workout scene?
Oh my God.
Oh yeah, it's so crazy.
I felt genuine anxiety that they had to have a serious conversation while doing any kind of exercise.
That's hard to do, by the way, as an actor.
And also just the concept of like anytime I've ever gone to a workout class with a friend, I'm like, we're both in our respective zones, right? And it's like, meanwhile, they have to like hash out like Midge's issues
that
like
is such
while
a, such,
working
you know,
out. I felt such stress for them.
I compare this as to the trope of in American like TV and movies where people don't say goodbye when they hang up. It's just not a thing that happens.
Exactly. That's so, yes.
And people from other countries see that and they're like, do they do that? Like, we don't go to yoga. Like, there's this amazing scene in Sex and the City where Carrie and Samantha are in yoga class. Yep. And Samantha's, like, doing the poses and being like, well, just fuck him or right. whatever. And Carrie's just literally sitting on the mat, like, head in hands, being like, I don't know. Like, what's with guys? And it's just like, she's not even doing the poses. Like, she's just like,
guys, just work out and talk afterwards.
Yeah, it's so crazy. And it's, like, it's so funny to me because once I hadn't done yoga when I first saw that. And I, like, after doing it, I was like, that would be insane if somebody was in a yoga class just hanging out talking.
Talking at all.
So bananas.
I also had a question for you guys. Do you, because I haven't researched it, but was the exercise sequence, how was that informed? Did they make it up, or is that something that they, I guess they did extensive research to find out how women worked
well,
out?
Well, I'm so glad you asked,
boy.
Jamie.
I had a feeling you
so,
knew.
So, in an interview in Entertainment Weekly, we can post this in the show notes, too. In an interview in Entertainment Weekly, Donna Zakowska, I hope I'm not mispronouncing that, she's a costume designer of the show. So she had her work cut out for her. And
they wore flats to work out. Yeah. They wore ballet, like little ballet flats. Yeah. Like so, the least comfortable shoe. I always get blisters from them.
Make Puff Physique do this Mrs. Maisel class.
Oh, yeah, like Maisel yoga. She said in the interview, most women in the 1950s didn't exercise in the way we do now. They either took ballet classes or took classes at special studios. That whole sequence with all those women in those little shorts and sweaters, I found a little real research on the Helena Rubinstein exercise salon. And it was sort of amusing because you think of moving in very stretching clothing. These women wore these little shorts. Sometimes they even kept their shoes on. And then they have little sweaters, these very fitted little outfits for actually pretty strenuous exercises. I'd also found a picture of this exercise they did holding a bottle between their feet. And Amy put that into the sequence.
Yep.
So that did come from like research, I guess, of maybe specifically the Helena Rubinstein stuff. But yeah, it was informed by that.
I was watching it going, I bet this is a real thing that people did for like maybe even it was only like a few years.
Because it was too weird to not be a real thing
exactly.
in a way.
Yeah.
It had a little bit of a Tracy Anderson vibe as well because the instructor didn't speak that much.
Yeah.
And in Tracy Anderson, they don't talk to you. I only took one class, but what? I found it interesting. So you just go in and the instructor just starts doing dance moves and you just copy them and don't talk. She isn't like, all right, and jumping jacks. It's just like you follow her and it's like very unspoken. So it reminded me of that a little bit. Obviously the instructor wasn't talking because the two leads are talking
right.
But
they had to go through three different people because the instructor kept talking.
It did remind me of that though because I was like, oh, that's like what it is to take a Tracy Anderson class where you actually could talk to someone because the instructor isn't speaking.
Shouts to Bailey DeYoung as Imogen, which is kind of a thankless role. She's in the Suki St. James role in this show in a big way.
She's perfect.
Yeah.
She's so great.
She's so perfect.
She's all pro. Guys, can we talk about this?
This is the solemn vow made by mathematics. In this room, V2 is never going to break that vow and decide that it doesn't need the other vector anymore and that it's going to run off and become linearly
huge classroom set.
V2 is never going to come home from work one day and tell V1, you know what? I think I need my own vector space. See ya. And then V1's dad has to come in and tell her, no, you can't let V2 do that. You gotta go get V2 back.
Back.
V1's dad is not gonna be around forever. Solve all of V1's problems.
The best is the button at the end where he goes,
write that down.
Brilliant.
I feel like Tony Shalhoub is singing every one of his lines in the show in a very real way. Like everything is a little bit melodic and he goes legato and then he goes staccato and then melody in everything he's saying, it feels like, in a way that I really appreciate.
Yeah, he's really home enjoy. Too. And that he scene is so great because what an elegant way to summarize why it matters. What matters about this breakup to him and why it matters to him and the part about him not being around forever and his responsibility to guide his daughter. And it's like, oh, okay, that makes sense now. Yeah. I don't need to be in this family to know, you know what I mean? Like, I don't need to be submerged in this kind of like family and this Upper West Side like dichotomy to know, oh, that's why he cares. Done.
A lot of economy in the storytelling.
So much economy.
For sure.
So much economy. Paris is wonderful, but it's good Midge didn't go. There was danger for her there.
Too much bread.
Yes.
Yes. That was the original bread. Yes.
Danger.
This is when, of course, Mrs. Weissman goes to see Drina, the fortune teller.
Love her friend. Drina. Her friend.
Freaking funny.
Such a weird
thing. The scope of this show already in episode two is like, this is a wide world. I feel New York. I feel like all these periphery characters are so fun.
It's so check cool. In with. Yeah. Because in Stars Hollow, that was like, the world, and it was kind of like a 4-block radius, and it was like our town, and we knew all these people, mm-hmm. and we were doing that, but in the city mm-hmm. of New York, which is crazy awesome, I think.
Yeah.
To be able to have that.
I love the moment at the end when Drina asks for her payment.
Yeah.
Take it from me. Are you paying by check?
She goes, it's just that little right before. It's such great so good, acting.
Yeah. Are you paying by check?
And I like that for Mrs. Weissman, that this is like a salacious, forbidden thing for her to go to the fortune. That she like does laps around it before actually going in. Like she's trying to shake a tail or something.
It also reminds me of my mom, because my mom thinks that she's friends with people she has to pay.
Yep.
Like my mom legitimately thinks like she's great friends with her hairdresser, and I'm like, he charges you so much money. He has never once given you a discount. I'm pretty sure he's charging even more now because he has more clients and he's like building his business. Like she doesn't care. She's like, I gotta get him a Christmas present. And I'm like, okay,
you can't put a price on friendship.
You made me just realize that I have that relationship with my hairstylist.
That's she's good. So it's sweet though.
She's like always about to come to one of my shows but never does, and I'm like, oh my god. Maybe that's part of it.
Maybe she's your Drina.
Maybe she's my Drina.
And shouts out to Mike in Pasadena at Mike's Barbershop, who I see every 4 months, and we don't talk that much. But I wrote him a nice Yelp review one time.
Oh, you did?
He's your Drina.
I just want to be part of this conversation.
Oh, okay, great.
Doesn't take much to have a Drina.
I guess not.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Yeah, so the whole thing, all of this is hinging on, the whole episode is hinging on the Yom Kippur.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm pronouncing that correct, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, don't look at me, but yeah, I think so.
Is it Yom Kippur?
I've heard both, honestly, so I accept both, okay. But I can't speak for everyone.
Well, can you speak for everyone just right now? Is it okay?
I think it's right, Yom Kippur. Great. I kind of blur them together when I say it, just to cover my bases. Yom Kippur.
Just pretend you're in a hurry.
Yeah.
You just always have to pretend you're in a hurry.
Oh, I gotta go to Yom Kippur.
So you see a lot of echoes of Gigi, not Christopher's daughter, but Gilmore Girls, the TV show, in that it is like a lot of families conspiring to keep a nuclear family unit intact.
Yep.
And Gilmore is, you're pregnant, so become a nuclear family. And this, it's like, you're already one and it's falling apart. Please stay together for the sake of, you know, public perception and you know, the perception that Midge is going to become like a spinster who does jigsaw puzzles, I think someone says at one point in the episode. So it all comes out of concern, but it's just a little misplaced. But I almost feel like one of the ways that it contrasts with Gilmore is, and maybe this is a function of Gilmore was a long show with 22 episodes a season. This is an 8-episode show. Mm-hmm. But Gilmore Girls seems to be a lot more focused on like waspy passive aggression.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, we don't talk about that. Like the big blow up dinner scene in Gilmore happens in like season 6 of the show.
Yeah.
Whereas this is like episode 2. We're just doing this. Yeah. We're going for it.
And I think it's like, that is the waspy thing, I think. That is like your justification for keeping it boiled, like under, you know, at a simmer all the time. But this scene has my favorite element, detail, which is that everybody's telling Midge to wear this red dress to get Joel back.
You know? Sure.
And she's like, I'm not going to fucking wear the red dress. You know, I'm not, this is not happening. I'm not getting Joel back. We're over. He cheated. It's fine.
Her mom has that amazing line.
Mom, if you have to see Joel, then he has to see you. And if he has to see you, he should see what he's missing.
That is not what this dinner's for.
You're a single woman now. That's what every dinner's for.
Ooh.
Mm. Ouch. God. Ouch. Right? So stressful.
Oh, God.
If my mom talked to me like that, oh, my God. So, and then she's like, and then cut to, Joel arrives. She's wearing the red dress.
Mm-hmm.
And her, the if you have it pulled up, the clip where she's talking to Joel and the way she talks to him, it's like,
Joel.
Sorry. I didn't knock. I just started to come in, but then I didn't know if I should, so I closed it.
So what's the verdict? In or out?
In.
Living room's that way, unless you forgot.
I want to get a jacket.
Yeah. Wasn't sure if you forgot.
Been gone one day, Midge.
That long, huh?
This has gone really well.
Oh, yeah.
She is on guard when she sees Joel. She's like, I'm ready to bicker with you. We're not in a pleasant place. Fuck you. It's all like, she comes out like knives out with mm-hmm. Joel. But she's wearing the dress, which to me is like perfect,
so perfect.
Right?
Yes, of course. I would so wear the dress.
I would so wear the dress. And then I'd be like, hey, fuck you, motherfucker. But like, but still like as though I'm straddling, but I've got my foot in both doors or whatever, which is so not a thing. And but it is in a way like that. That is so relatable to me.
Yeah. And there's a great quote from Zukowski on that, too. She says, Midge wears a gorgeous red dress gown meant to wow him. However, the design was more about showing Midge's inner strength and independence than impressing her husband. That was a design that might have been pulled from Vogue, but the idea there was that, and I had said that to Amy, and then it ended up in the script, which was, I really want her to be very strong when he comes back. I want to feel like, I know you've left me. I don't care. I am here. Mm-hmm. I am strong. I am assertive. I'm in no way meek about this. I just wanted to give her the strength and power of being seductive and yet being her own person.
Okay, but I don't see it that way.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you see it?
I don't know. I'm just kidding. I feel like, you know that song Irreplaceable by Beyonce?
To the left, to the left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everything you own.
Mm-hmm.
So that song is all about like how I don't give a fuck. You're gone. I can replace you in a minute. You didn't matter to me. But the key that the song is in is like a minor key. So it sounds sad. Mm-hmm. There's nothing about if you just didn't understand English, if you heard that song, it would not sound like a anthem of like moving on. Yeah. It would sound like come back to me. I miss you. And to me that is exactly what this red dress moment is about. It's like, fuck you, I don't care, I'm fine. But she's not dressed like she's fine. She's right. dressed like she still wants him to right. at least know that there's a tiny little torch, maybe like a pocket lighter sized torch that she's carrying.
Yeah, that's it's like one foot in, one foot out.
There is that slight vulnerability.
Well, there was also that moment when he says, you look beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh, what is this going to lead to? Mm-hmm. Like, are they going to have a moment? And then he kind of just starts talking about the kids. And it was a little like, oh,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not that the kids aren't her. They are a piece of her, but they're not their relationship. Yeah. They're like the other.
The kids are so inconsequential. Little Esther,
Ethan.
Which, speaking of which, I think it's time for a segment, which I don't have a theme for, called Paladinoisms.
Okay.
Paladinoisms. These are things that Amy and Dan have maybe done on one show that they might repeat in terms of thematics. We see that in like a big family conflict at a dinner, but then specific even lines or phrases or thoughts or ideas. So the Paladinoism in this episode comes from when Susie shows up at Midge's place.
I knew it.
Susie shows up and she's like, hey, you were late. What the hell? You said 9:30. I'm never up at 9:30. And by the way, that was the only moment I didn't totally love in this episode because it just felt like Susie was talking for 3 minutes straight.
It was.
But a lot of it was filler.
It didn't move the story forward. Yeah. It really was just like, hey, look at this interesting shot we are exploring.
Yeah. And the two apartments and whatever.
And it's very theatrical. It doesn't feel like a TV show. It truly feels like we've moved to the stage at this point.
Totally.
Yeah. Also, kind of, to me, maybe voice of the audience about, like, we're all wondering, you know, what, because, like, the first episode when she goes to her mom's house,
mm-hmm.
I was a little confused when she walks into somebody else's house and is like, they're offering her coffee just so casual. Like, she works there.
Yeah. So she was an audience surrogate of like, oh, you have two, you have a backup,
two houses.
Blah, blah, blah.
What's going on here? And then making this running commentary about like how it's, you know, the Scheherazade or whatever.
Yeah. And at that point, I'm taken. Susie to be that neurotic. But then when she started talking like that, I was like, oh, she is. And you see more shades of that in the episodes going forward. But in particular, she had a line about her children, about Midge's children, that seemed to echo something else in Gilmore Girls.
You've met my children.
I did. One of them gave me bubonic plague.
It was jelly. God damn it. Children get jelly on their hands.
I don't even like kids. They're always sticky, you know, like they've got jam on their hands. Even if there's no jam in the house, somehow, they've always got jam on their hands.
Total Paladino. Oh, how do you
do that? Paladinoism. You're so impressive.
Well, that's something a lot of listeners pointed out, too, even before we recorded. But it was like immediately, whoa.
Yeah.
And that's from episode 204 of Gilmore Girls.
I feel like you're a Paladino bot.
011 Paladino bot. I don't give a shit. Top hat 011. Yeah, so that'd be a Paladinoism for this episode.
That's great.
I do like the did you guys buy the refusal of the call, like the classic hero's journey thing where Midge is like, no, I can't do that. That's not my life, blah, blah, blah. When Susie shows up, she's like, well, let's work on your bullshit. Let's do it.
Oh, you mean in the scene with the cakes?
Yeah.
By the way, I don't know if you guys noticed, the cake, there was some cake acting that I found to be particularly stressful.
Oh, no.
Okay, so she, quick, this is Jamie's Cake Corner.
Yeah.
New Jamie segment.
Cake Corner.
Thank you, Alice. So Susie takes the cake from Midge.
Yes, she does.
Takes a bite. Yeah. Takes a bite. And then gets annoyed that Midge is like, I don't want to pursue stand-up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Puts the cake on the couch.
Killed
in
me.
This immaculate room of the apartment. Then goes to exit. Then goes back in and takes a new cake. A full new cake.
Shit.
And leaves. So the old cake is still on the couch. New
just
cake.
Plateless?
Gone.
Susie,
plateless.
You
plateless.
Animal.
Oh, yeah. My God.
And I wondered how that, I mean, like, in the blocking, like, that was a very deliberate choice.
I
guess so. But I wonder what that meant to leave a cake on the couch, but then take the one off of the plate.
Yeah.
I know.
As opposed to just taking the one that you already started eating.
Well, hopefully we'll get some follow-up on this.
It feels
in
like one of those
two.
Moments where somebody's
I don't think we're done. I think we need to know more about the cake.
It sounds like one of those 2 second like just conversations with like a PA and the director and being like, "Just have her take a new one." Okay, well, we're not gonna. Okay, have her. So you're gonna hear. You heard that. You're going to take a new cake. Okay. We're good.
That is exactly what it was. Because it would take too much blocking for her to go back to the sofa.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The table was closer to the door.
Can you just try it? Going again?
Leave that other one on the couch. Yeah, plateless. Yeah, and napkinless. Yeah, just crumb it. Crumb it hard.
Just crumb it so hard, Alex.
Yes.
You got it.
And okay, so did you ever watch Desperate Housewives?
No.
Okay, so there's a scene in Desperate Housewives. It doesn't really matter, but the one who's like really buttoned up, the redhead.
Yes.
Stop looking at me.
And she is like, her house is immaculate. She's very Martha Stewart-y, and her husband and her
Marcia
are not
Cross.
Having, Marcia Cross.
Yes.
They're not having sex, and it's like a whole thing. And finally, they start having sex, and like he has left a burrito on the nightstand, and the burrito filling is like beany and cheesy, and it's spilling.
This
out
is
onto
really
the rug.
Stuck with you,
and it deserves its own episode.
It infuriated me because the whole implication is that, oh, just leave the burrito behind. It's your marriage, for Christ's sake. And I'm like, no. Don't leave a burrito on the nightstand, asshole. If you know I have a thing about this, it's like he's fucking gaslighting her. Or he's deliberately making a mess to tempt her to clean it and be like, and then when she, of course, is like, I gotta get it, he's like, oh, of course. It's like, well, you left a fucking
it's
cheesy
a burrito. You're the asshole. Nightstand.
Anyway, thank you. Ooh, that felt good to get out.
This has been Jamie's Cake Corner.
I'm Jamie's Cake Corner.
Ooh, little nice. Reggie Watts vibe there. I
like to think that me and Alice combined make one Reggie Watts.
Yeah, Reggie Watts.
Strange.
One Watt.
One Reggie Watt.
We need three more.
There's
for
like
two.
Three more Watts that need to be.
Here's my favorite line of the episode, though.
Can I see you in the bedroom a minute? Can I see you two in the bedroom a minute?
He says it two different times in the exact same intonation of voice.
Ooh. Tony Shalhoub?
That's the Shalhoub as Abe Weissman having a word with Joel.
Oh, right.
And then Midge.
I remember.
Yeah.
It is so strange to ask someone, can I see you in the bedroom?
Can I see you in the bedroom? Yeah.
It's like, that's not where conversations happen.
Right.
But apparently, it is a reminder that they're in an apartment in New York City, and like that is the reality.
Yeah, but it's like palatial, right?
Yeah, that is the thing. Feel like they'd have like, can I see you in the study? Or I don't know. Yeah, the bedroom is a little odd.
I think the bedroom is like the most off limits and the rudest it would be for any other guest to like go in there and intrude.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's why maybe I took that's it.
Maybe it's a privacy thing.
I am not a violent man, Joel. But if I were, I would take you upstairs to my apartment and throw you out the window. Do you know why I'm not throwing you out this window?
No.
Because my window's on a higher floor and I want to make sure it sticks.
Abe.
No. You do not call me Abe.
No.
What do I call you?
He's singing.
He is.
You call me nothing.
Wow. Totally. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
That was satisfying to me. I had to see that. It's like he has to take him to task.
Did you guys enjoy all the conflict and yelling and crisscross of the whole dinner scene? Did it make sense for you guys?
Yeah. I've watched the episode twice now. The first time I saw it, it just felt...
It felt a little shrill the first time
it
for
did.
Me.
It did. And then the second time, I kind of appreciated like the choreography of it and like... I like the parents arguing.
Yeah.
It ramps up rather quickly, but it would. But it's funny that it does because it's like they've orchestrated this whole thing and then they all kind of sabotage it in a way by not doing the right.
Doesn't Joel's dad call him, I can't remember. I think he calls him a toddler or he calls him.
Toddlers, both of you.
I appreciated that because it even explains further. I mean, in-laws are always involved to some degree, especially in the Jewish New York community. Mm-hmm. I do feel like parents are very hands-on past the point of childhood.
Sure.
But in my own experience. But I really appreciated that, like, even in the 1950s when, like, you know, they're, what, 26 on the show, I think they're supposed to be?
Yeah, they're in their late 20s.
But I like that it's still like, yeah, but you're really young. Mm-hmm. I like that there's an acknowledgement of, like, 26 is still young, even in the 50s when, like, 26 wasn't young.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
I really, like, I thought that was kind of, like, a fun crossover from today.
And you get a good sense of the history of conflict in the family. It doesn't feel like, oh, this is the first time all these actors are in a scene together. It's like, oh, they've been going at this shit for years since they've been married. Like the thing with
self-sacrifice is often necessary, like sacrifice I made pulling 13 God, so Jews good. Out of Germany in 1943. I got that.
When Midge and April,
here we go.
At the same time, you just get it.
Yeah,
get
I love a here we go.
I love a here we go.
Here we go says everything.
You know what? I take it back. This is my favorite line of the episode.
Zelda is not a servant. She's an employee.
Family.
Family, too. And well paid. Incredible. With vacation time. She went to Holland last year.
Iceland.
Better than Holland.
Better than Holland.
Iceland. Better than Holland. Oh, it's so good.
It's great.
Yeah, the jokes with Zelda were excellent.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes.
Is this the episode... Does she get... They're bleeding together for me a little bit because I did rewatch it. I did rewatch it. I watched it. I've watched the whole show.
You're not on trial. You're not on trial here.
Don't.
Hey, you watched it before. I'm
doing great.
Yeah, we're doing good.
Is this? She gets back on stage in this episode, right?
She does.
Yeah. She does.
This episode.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
So the conflict of Yom Kippur. Sorry, guys. I'm always gonna. Should I just say sorry, guys? After
sorry,
every
guys. Instead of Yom, you're not allowed to say Yom Kippur.
So on the night of sorry, guys.
Yeah. That's offensive.
The conflict reaches a fever pitch level. That then, after refusing Susan and be like, no, no, thanks, she does rush back to the gaslight. At which point, in a stunning bit of choreography.
Oh, wow. It was...
This was what I was so excited for you to see. The whole time I watched the entire series, this moment.
It's pretty terrific. I would say to Amy Sherman-Palladino...
Yep, me too.
For a writer that doesn't have a huge amount of experience with a lot of great... characters that are people of color, maybe choose a different person to literally push off the stage
literally
for your white
stand-up. Interrupt.
Ridiculous.
She waltzes on stage and just, and then that was it. And there was no like, hey, it was just like, the woman on stage kind of like,
she's like, what the hell? Come on. Yeah.
Did she say something?
Yeah. She was like, oh, come on. What? Yeah.
Because it's funnier for it to move so quickly. It just
and it was funny. It's just tempered with that.
I know.
I don't think it's intentional at all. I think it's just tone deaf, right?
Yeah, it's tone deaf, and it drives me crazy because it's such a good moment. And if it had been some male folk
some guy
that we had done a joke of before,
I would have loved it.
Some dork with a banjo,
absolutely.
Whatever.
Yeah. Get rid of banjo guy. I know.
But otherwise, a a terrific piece of choreography and really fun.
I know. And honestly, it was so good that it was almost like not ruined for me, because it was like, because I like the idea of this, her making this joke with this poet, and this poet has, you know, and there is a part of me that's like, well, okay, but aren't we allowed to, aren't like characters of color, if it wasn't problematic, aren't characters of color allowed to be playing the butt of the joke, you know what I mean? Like,
oh, totally,
you know, like,
yeah.
The thing about, I know, it's like that Ace Ventura thing where, like, only a fucking white guy gets to be the anti-hero who's so stupid, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't ever see,
that's
like,
Ventura law, yeah.
I can't remember who, what black actor was saying, like, comedian, it might have been, I don't remember who it was, but he was saying, like, a guy, like, I don't get to play Ace Ventura. Like, I don't get to be that character, because yeah. I always have to be, you know, on top. I have to be, like, more intelligent.
And the respectable one. Like, yeah. you saw that a lot in the early aughts, yeah. I feel like. They would make people of color into authority figures. Like, yeah. the president on 24.
Yeah.
Or they made Carl Lumley on Alias, the director of the agency or whatever it is. So, yeah, it should go both ways. But yeah. I think just given this particular writer's history with it, that's why it's like,
yeah, because if this was
a little hard to take, yeah.
If the writer of the show was black, it would have been a completely different thing. Like, if it was, you know, Jordan Peele writing the whole thing, and like it would be easily one of the greatest, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, not the same exact moment, but like without all the context of problematic shit going on. So, but yeah, I love that.
But that said, what a great scene. And this is where it really crystallizes that her stand up isn't going to be like, stand-up is my product, and I create jokes.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
going to be an emotional overflow of her being, her life, her presence. It's going to be storytelling, observational stuff, rather than what's the deal stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, that's really cemented in this scene.
Yeah.
You've heard about the shorthand girls? These are girls whose skill in life is not writing full sentences. Meanwhile, I went to college to learn Russian. And speaking of vodka, why don't they serve booze here? I need a drink. A stiff drink. I need a drink so stiff I can blow it.
And it's nice, like what
sounds
you were
like
saying
one of my shows.
About
Popeye.
But it's fun to see that, like, it is imperfect. There's weird pauses at the beginning.
That's really funny. And the reason it's so funny is because I used to live in the large house on the hill, and now I live nowhere. As of an hour ago, my address changed to haunt.
There's the lady that was offended by it that storms out.
Yep.
It's not funny throughout. It builds
that.
With steam in a way. Like, is there anything that either of you found to be accurate or inaccurate to your own experiences in this particular scene?
I mean, to me, it reminds me of a super aggressive Mike Birbiglia. Like, that's the way it kind
of
moves.
Oh, yeah, I could see that. Yeah, because it's so perspective inflected. It's not like someone else besides Midge
Maisel
could be doing that. Yeah, and
there's long periods with no laughter that are not about, like, creating laughter. It's like, I'm giving you this context mm-hmm. from my experience, and that's like, I'm not focused on making every line into a joke.
And you can also tell that she's very comfortable in that room, because even prior to her doing stand-up in the room, she's visited that room so many times prior with Joel. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's something about the familiarity with that space that she is especially fearless there.
Yeah.
Whereas I think, and not to like give away later episodes or anything, but I do think once she's thrown into different spaces, that's where her confidence starts to sort of shake. Mm. And I think that it is interesting to see someone sort of in their element in their home club, because I do think that you get a little more comfortable and you're more experimental than you might be in a place that you've never played.
Yeah. One of the moments I really appreciated as someone who's not a stand-up but has consumed a lot is the point where she goes over to the woman's table and doesn't like heckle her, do crowd work, or call her out, but just like focuses on her when she's talking about fairy tales. Like
when you were a little girl, and people say the princess lived in a magic castle for 100 years, and then the prince climbed up the side, slayed a dragon, kissed her, woke her up, and they lived happily ever after. And you think, that's plausible. A couple of details are fuzzy, but sure.
Because she's doing the thing that you end up needing to figure out how to do everywhere you go, which is treating this room and this audience that, like, my friend, the audience.
Yep.
This person that I know, that I come back to and talk to. Mm-hmm. And it's not like a group of strangers. It's like a singular entity that is my friend, the audience. And because she's in this environment where she's been before, like Jamie was saying, you know, that it comes naturally. Like she does it automatically without these people who have not been there last week, you know, but she's suddenly acting like, anyway, you remember about this. It's like, no, we don't. Cause you know, but she's doing that familiarity thing. So important to
which then breeds intimacy, yeah,
yeah, with and, the audience.
And her manager believes in her so hard that I think having that person who's like, no matter what happens in the audience, I believe in you and I want to listen to everything you're saying because everything you say is like truly brilliant. I think it also gives her a boost, like just having that person in the room. Like it's like the opposite of a cooler. Like it's like a warmer. And I think that it's a warmer. I think that she, I think her manager lifts her up a lot in those in those early days.
For the guests, the people listening who don't know what a cooler is. Maybe you want.
There's a William H. Macy documentary.
It's when the when you're doing a set and somebody starts playing the William H. Macy documentary.
Really, really cools you off.
It's just,
It is a documentary.
I don't know if you felt that, Alice, but I've had, when I was first starting out, and also still sort of happens, there would be certain people I was on a lineup with, and I was like, every time they're on a show with me, I don't do as well. It was just like this weird thing I created in my head. It was not true, but I was like, they're my cooler.
I mean, for me, my family.
Really?
Yeah, I hate when my family's in the audience.
Yeah, I think there's a
history. I mean, I don't
a lot
love
of
it.
People have said that, like, anytime your family's there.
Yeah.
Because it's like,
it's hard to have a great show in front of them.
I never want to do a stand-up for
smiling
family.
Fucking faces are just, they're like so excited.
They love you.
And so proud.
Supportive.
And it's like, it bothers me. Because it's like, I don't come, it's like, this is where I work. And
I
even
know.
Though it's where I talk to a group of people and we all have fun, it's strange that it's like my family coming to and being like, it's just weird. And it's
I
don't want, I'm a different person with you guys, and I'm a person I need to be with you guys, and I don't want you coming in here and giving me the sensation that I have to be that person, you know, like it just puts this fucking leash on me, and I hate
did
it.
I just did a show this past week where my mother and father-in-law and my uncle and cousin came, and they all love stand-up. They're super supportive and cool. And there was still a feeling of like, there were even some jokes where I was like, I don't think I should do that if they're here.
Because you can't.
And that sucks because you just want to say your thing. These are the things that I talk about. I don't want to be editing last minute.
It's a sacred space.
And editing on stage is the other thing.
Because
you're not going to go over every single joke and
stressful
line.
Like 20 times. I have the lowest threshold, you guys.
It's like you're not going to go over every line and every bit, so you're going to go on stage and start being like, I think this is all okay. And then you're just going to start saying, oh yeah, that's right. There's a line in which, you know, a guy fucks my ear or something like that, you know?
Exactly.
And I forgot about that until I'm here, standing here, and then you in your head see it coming down the pipe. And you kind of, and then you tense up, and then the audience is like, wait, why did that?
They can feel
tense?
The shift too. They don't realize that you're trying to change your act on the spot because there are people in the audience who might not approve.
So crazy.
That said, I'm looking forward to emailing this episode of the podcast to both of your parents.
Well, you do that every time, and I've discussed why I don't want you to. And you have a very close relationship with them, and that's again
with your
thing.
Parents, yes. Not my own.
This feels
you're
like a boundary.
You're my only friend that I'm in couples therapy with, and I want you to know that.
Well,
I don't
we
do
talked
this
about
everybody.
We talked about that last episode.
I know.
We are not in couples therapy.
Okay.
Because I was saying we're in a polyamorous relationship in that you have two co-hosts on two different podcasts.
I know, but that why would I think that?
Because it's a fun analogy. See,
oh,
this
look at listen to you like fall apart at the end of what you just said. Oh, I love it. Hey, I'm here. I got your back. All right.
I got your back
right?
too.
Three billboards.
Three billboards.
All right, three billboards later. I got your back.
We don't need to talk about three billboards.
No, we don't.
No, we don't.
No, we don't.
Tune into my show, folks.
Two.
Tune in next week when my grandmother steals
three,
my pearls and fucks my boyfriend.
Four.
Five.
That's a pretty good ender.
That's a great ender.
That's a good closer
so
for the episode.
Good.
And then it smash cuts to the credits with Rebel Rebel.
Yeah.
Not the David Bowie Ridge, but a cover of it. A cover of it, because I'm sure they could. But it is like, it was interesting in this interview they did with Vulture about the music licensing. Apparently, I thought it'd be the opposite, but it's more expensive to license music in needle drops now than it was even 10, 15, 20 years ago. So every time they're doing it, it is more of like a budget flex of, we can get the Barry Sisters. We can get Frank Sinatra. We can get Barbara Streisand twice in the episode. But on that note, I think it might be fun to do a little Twitter Q&A.
Twitter Q&A.
Twitter Q&A.
tweet, tweet.
Still using that. All right. Why not?
Like a ghost in the air. So Twitter Q&A.
An air ghost.
You know, one of them air ghosts.
One of them air ghosts.
Okay, so this question comes from S. Woods. It's directed to Alice. I'll direct it to Jamie as well. Do you think Midge's second time doing stand-up and succeeding was a bit of a stretch? Is it real for her to have done a great set with no preparation twice now?
I think it's believable given the time and, again, given just her fearlessness. Mm-hmm. I think that so much of stand-up in the beginning is like maybe you're... jokes are not the thing you're the most proud of, but just kind of faking it till you make it, you can have some really great sets. And it actually starts to fuck with your head a little bit.
Yeah.
Because then you can't necessarily replicate that sure. as you go on. Because you don't, you actually lose a lot of that as you go. And then you have to build it back up
again. You lose the new joke energy, the
yes,
new bit energy.
Yes. Ooh. And I think that it is believable that like her excitement is the thing that people are excited about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you go on stage, it's like that's why you have to work bits over and over, because when you go on stage for the first time with a new bit and it kills, you're like, you're never really that excited, because you're like, oh good, well that was fun, but it's, that doesn't mean it's a good bit, that just means it's not the worst, you know, that mm-hmm. just means that it's not gonna be something I immediately never do again, or I have to completely rewrite. And we discussed this right on the first episode,
I think a little bit.
The realism of that moment, I think, yeah,
yeah.
I mean, because yeah, just tagging on to what Jamie says. You know, the first time I did stand up, I killed two in front of five people because of that total freedom of not having any other sets behind me that I had failed at. So it was like, sure, whatever. This is, you know, I may never do this again. You know, and I yeah. that's the other thing. If you do stand up once and you know you're never going to do it again, you're going to kill. Yeah, there's nothing. You have no skin in the game.
There's nothing to lose.
So.
Okay, so it was realistic on some level.
Oh, for sure.
Her devil may care.
For sure.
And I think if she continued to only have wins along the way, I think that we'd start to be like, okay, but that's not necessarily the case.
It's not the case, as we'll see in future episodes. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah.
Esther writes in, money seems to be a huge theme in ASP's shows. What's the difference between Joel and Midge's families in the context of class and wealth? Because that's something we didn't really touch on a little bit, in that Joel's dad, Moisha, does flex and say like, well, I own your apartment, I'm going to kick you out. And I gave you Miss Moskowitz and move Penny Pan, which I do like that Miss Moskowitz just seems like a Mrs. Landingham reboot from the West Wing.
I'm your new girl, Mrs. Moskowitz.
My
funny little story. I met you when you were an itty bitty boy. That's how long I've been working here.
So yeah, it feels like Joel's family, it is more about control and power with him, because it's like, oh, your uncle gave you the job, whereas the like Midge's family seems to be about setting her up for success to be absorbed into a wealthy and powerful man, and not so much about controlling her life per se, although it might become about that later.
Well, Joel's family are, you know, Joel's dad is a self-made, you know, millionaire or whatever, because he's got all this. He made this company, right? Mm-hmm. And he talks about that. And he's so super proud of it. And he's one of those guys that, like, built this empire. And so that's a huge part of, like, who he is. And it makes sense for Joel to be not really able to do it, you know, because he didn't watch. Like, he grew up, to grow up under somebody who, like, got that, it's really hard to instill a kid with a ton of privilege with that, you know, bootstrap mentality. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Maisel is different, where he's a professor. You know, I was thinking about that. Like, he just teaches. He's like a tenured professor. So he makes money, but it's like,
Columbia, yeah.
Yeah, that can't be the same as what, you know, what Joel's dad is making.
I do love this gag.
No, 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 no. Truman.
Again.
Bueller.
It's all music. Yeah, it's Bueller, Bueller. Kayla says, how much do you love that speakerphone? That was a weird gag.
That was so cute.
I didn't get it. Did those exist in 1958?
I guess so. Yeah. I guess so.
That's
weird. It felt like the type of thing where they're like, we want to show you that we knew that this was a thing back then. And we're going to bring it.
Right.
We're going
to
incorporate it.
Too much specific like, to not be real.
Yeah, much like Midge's parents want to show them that they have a speakerphone.
Oh, I see. Oh, it's a show of power.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Avneet says, is taste and typography Amy's biggest weakness? Talking about the fonts on screen for like the Thursday night title card and all the title cards.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
Because it is like ooh, this doesn't feel classy.
I know, like, it doesn't.
Pink on black, which I know pink is like a, it's actually, pink is the thematic choice for this show. It, and like where it pops up.
I didn't notice, I mean, I did notice it without being able to like speak about it. Right. I guess it did jump out at me, but now that it's we're talking about it, I'm like, oh yeah, that's crazy.
That's kind of odd.
It does. It just looks, it just doesn't look as polished
there's
as everything
else. There's another
show,
that I've been watching where it was like maybe concurrently that made it seem okay. That show, the Western one.
Godless?
Godless.
Okay.
The fucking font on Godless is like Helvetica.
Comic Sans MS.
It's super weird. It's like nothing. It just black. It's just white on black. It's like they did an iMovie. It's like Arial or something.
So that's how like, that's how I feel like the ones for this show. Spotless. I feel like it's very iMovie.
Like, you know, there's people who do this for a living and they need jobs. Okay, that's all.
I know for a fact that Amy figured out how to use iMovie in the break between Gilmore Girls.
Shut up. Seriously?
Well, she I will say it at the ATX festival 3 years ago, she edited the tribute to Edward Herman, and they made a big deal like Amy edited this herself.
Wow.
And it was clearly iMovie.
Oh my God.
As lovely as that tribute was. This is more of a rhetorical question, but Rachel says, "Do you feel like Susie's saw your act?" is similar to ASP's reaction to the Gilmore Guys podcast.
Hilarious.
I know for a fact that it is.
Really?
I mean, she's never listened, I'm sure. God, I hope
so not. No, it isn't, because she wouldn't, she'd be like, didn't see your act if she had to.
Jordana finally says, I'm curious.
Finally, Jordana.
Finally. Cough it out, Jordana. I'm curious if without a basic knowledge of Yiddish American culture, do you ever think you miss jokes? Are there many words the parents use that are lost on you? Because we're just two Maisel Goyes.
I never miss a joke, Jordana.
I don't know who that is.
I don't know either. She's gone anyway.
I kind of chalk it up to the references, like in Gilmore, where it's like, I don't know what that reference is in
right.
reference to. But
yeah, there are definitely things that I miss.
Yeah, same here.
Just like in my life.
But it just sort of like creates the world.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, I just chalk it up to like, that just adds to the whole environment of the
Easter
show.
Easter eggs, you know?
Exactly.
Oh, honorable mention
but
to this
Easter,
line.
But not Easter, because it's Passover
not Easter,
eggs.
Easter, yeah.
Sorry.
Ooh, whatever the Passover eggs is what you said? Yeah, Passover eggs.
What's this for?
Oh, my God. God, that's amazing.
MVP. MVP.
MVP.
The Maisel valuable player.
Valuable player.
Is Ave Weissman.
Ave Weissman.
Anything else we want to talk about before we wrap things up on the marvelous Mrs. Maisel?
I just got some personal stuff going on.
Yeah, let's talk about your personal life real quick.
Just kidding.
Okay. Anything in the episode? Anything with the soundtrack or the costumes or the lavish production
overall,
design?
Like, I was sucked in from the pilot, and this is just like the, you know, if you think of the second episode as the sophomore, you know, it didn't. Maybe that's why they spent so much money on it or something to make it such a big world, to keep it going, you know, to keep the momentum from the pilot. But it was great. It succeeded perfectly.
Yeah, and the season ramps up.
Yeah.
So.
Totally.
So good.
I keep thinking, I watch every episode like, okay, this is going to be the one where they're like, shit, we used our budget. Let's just do, you know, a whole episode of The Apartment. But there's more sets. There's more costumes. And so many extras. In every episode.
All in costumes.
You have to costume each of the...
I think about it a lot. I mean, again, not to spoil, but some of the department store stuff coming
out.
Yes. Whew.
For sure.
I know. I'm like, where is that magical place that I can
go to,
please?
I want
to
go there so badly. And I want to buy all the cosmetics.
I know. And again, I want them to be from the 50s.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So I'm giving this up. I mean, we don't really rate it on this show because we enjoy all of it. And it's such a long, continuous thing. I'll give this overall Maisel Tove. For
Maisel
sure.
Tove. Oh,
not a Schlemazel.
Did you do on Gilmore Guys like a 5 out of...
Yeah, but I don't really care about
that?
I feel like it gets too technical and analytical, and I want this to be more
takes
breezy.
Forever.
Yeah, because it's like, ooh, what would I give? And then it's just, who cares? It's a made-up arbitrary
thing.
It's such a magical world to get to be a part of watching the show.
Because that's the thing. If something isn't working on a story level, then it switches to... Oh, just luxuriate in watching the production design.
Absolutely.
And what it must have been on Mad Men. And actually, that brings me, because I was reading a recap of this. This is from Ariel Bernstein on the AV Club. Mm-hmm. I thought she made a really fascinating point. She said, back when Mad Men was on the air, Many viewers reveled in a strange kind of nostalgia for the style mm-hmm. and sensibilities of an older era. Folks hosted Mad Men themed parties and ladies yep. debated if they yeah. were a Joan or a Peggy. Don Draper's macho swagger was written about lovingly as he seduced or even harassed female coworkers and constantly cheated on his wife. Perhaps back in 2007, many viewers felt safely held in a post-feminist world where we could look back on the olden days of retro-sexism and simply laugh. No more. It's 2017. We're all very well aware that the sexism of yore is just as palpable today as ever, with more and more men in the public eye being accused of sexual misconduct, harassment, and assault, and more women coming forward with stories about the way they've been impacted by sexism and misogyny. So just to say that
yeah.
it's cool to experience this show mm-hmm. through, like, in this climate, even though I have no illusions about Amy saying, I'm going to write a show about now
yeah.
and what it is to be a woman in 2018. Yeah, yeah. Like, I don't think she cares about any... I don't think it's her MO to no. work out social issues.
She was not wearing a Time's Up pin.
No. But it's cool to see, like, the kind of romanticism that came with a lot of the yeah. Mad Men stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
To kind of strip that away and be yeah. like, no, what? There's something called chronological snobbery, which is the idea that whatever time period you're in now, you assume to be the best time period right. because it's now.
Oh,
and what came before was like, oh, yeah, because they were dummies, because they didn't know back then, but we got figured out now. When really the more, like, humble perspective would be like, oh, how does that mirror what I'm experiencing now?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And what mm-hmm. issues still persist?
Which is yeah. why the show works so well.
I think yeah. so, yeah.
Because I feel like that's 100% what it does. It holds a mirror up to what is also still yeah. happening yeah. now and, yeah. and what has sort of fallen away. But not really. I feel like all of it is... It's unfortunately, it yeah. all feels very current.
Mm-hmm.
The feelings I get from watching the show feel very now.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Jamie, thanks so much for joining us on
this
show.
This is so fun. Thank you for having me.
Yet another banger, guys.
What a dream.
Guys, we did it.
We did it. Wait, did we have a correction section?
Earlier.
I think we did it, right?
Yeah. It's just that Yom Kippur is not for us to say.
Sure.
And to parody.
That's our correction section.
Yeah. Nobody else really had anything to say. And if they did, fuck them.
Okay. You can send in your corrections, feedback,
and maybe
positive, negative,
them
and otherwise.
So that we know. So that sure. we can see them easily next time. Hashtag correction section, please. Sorry.
Yeah, you can tweet at Gilmore Guys Show on Twitter, which I've changed section. The name to Maisel Goyes while we're
oh,
doing
cool.
this show.
Oh, nice.
But it's still at the handle is still at Gilmore
sure,
Guys
sure,
Show.
Sure, sure.
And then you can email Gilmore Guys Show at gmail.com for your some people sent him some really interesting,
they did.
Really well thought out emails.
Some people sent some thoughtless, really mean stuff. So please stop that.
Some I would classify as hate mail.
Yeah, I would too.
That didn't
yeah.
happen. That didn't happen.
Nope.
Okay, good. I was worried for a second.
Jamie, what do you have to plug? You're on Crashing.
I'm on Crashing.
This season.
Yes, I'm on Crashing on HBO.
Another show about a stand up
yeah,
making it in
I
New
play,
York.
And I play the 2018.
She plays a stand up comedian.
Yeah, so I get to draw fun parallels between me and Midge.
Yeah.
I haven't done that yet, but I will. I will. And then I have a book out. It's called Wediculous, and it's available in
book. Oh, you pronounce it
form.
Wediculous.
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 Yeah.
It's so great,
it's
you guys.
Wediculous, because it's a made up word. That's why I have to spell it.
But if you're not married, you're not allowed to read it.
True.
I very much encourage people who are not married to read it, because it definitely takes a crack at modern
it's
wedding
culture.
It's
the only book of its kind, and if you do have friends aww. Getting married, it's the perfect gift, because it's just like you should read that book instead of whatever else bullshit is out there. I'm serious.
So the
meaning I got married
of marriage
and I wish
by Tim Keller.
Oh, thank you. Also, I have an album coming out, which I should mention because I keep forgetting to mention. But my first stand-up album will be out January 19th.
Where'd you record it?
I recorded it in Philadelphia, cool. and it's called I Mean dot dot.
Oh,
dot,
I love it.
Which
That's
is
awesome.
Such a me title. Alice knows me. She can attest to
That's
that.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's called I Mean, and yes, and also. You can follow me on Twitter at @TheJamieLee and on Instagram at @ReallyJamieLee. That's Very it. Good. I'm done with plugs.
Hell yeah. Alice, what do you have to plug?
My album is actually coming out June 18th, and it's called I Mean. So that's, but not
this
without,
is interesting.
Without the ellipses.
This
so,
is interesting.
No, I, gosh almighty, I'll be at Flappers next Wednesday and the following Wednesday.
In beautiful
in
Burbank,
room.
California.
And you should come out to those shows because they're surprisingly fun. Hey, I shouldn't say surprisingly.
Yeah, that's a good club.
I love that club and I love performing there. So I'm going to be there Wednesday night in the Yoohoo Room on the 10th and Wednesday night on the 17th. And I'm going to be, let's see, I have other shows too. But you can check my calendar. for those, I guess. Oops, I just made a mistake.
And the Treks in the City podcast.
And I deleted all
my
contacts. And I also have another podcast called Treks in the City with Veronica Osorio, who is an upcoming guest on this show.
Does she feel neglected because you're doing this with me?
Yeah,
now?
She does.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we can hash that out when she comes on the show.
I think we'll have to talk about
it. It's going
to
be a really tense episode. I'm looking forward to it.
It will be tense. Icy.
I don't imagine it will be in any way enjoyable. So.
Yeah, so you can look forward to that in a few weeks.
Look for that.
You can follow me at Kevin T. Porter. You can catch me every week on Young Sheldon on CBS. I play the title character. and you can listen to my other podcast. The lack of response was alarming in the room. There was a second where you were like, wait, does he play Young
that
Sheldon?
Hit me on a lot of levels. I didn't realize that.
I love that.
And you can also listen to my other podcast, Good Christian Fun, which Alice has been a guest on.
Oh, I loved it.
We went and saw The Star.
We did.
Yeah, you don't... You,
to dedicate a lot of
You don't
of time.
Gotta be a Christian to listen to that show.
You don't gotta be a Christian
to listen to that show. Oh, you should come on the show too, Jane.
I would love it.
That'd be a fun time.
Oh my gosh.
We're doing Proverbs 31 Woman in February. So. Maybe a shoo-in for that.
It's a fun one.
And yeah. So thanks for listening to this, guys. I was really blown away by the response to the first episode.
Yeah, thanks, you guys.
I truly didn't know if anyone would care at all
if we put it out.
I do, about everything
People
in my
care.
Life.
They love you.
They love you, and they love you now, Jamie, now that you're part of the extended Gilmore Guys podcast universe, which we tried to have Jamie on the first podcast.
Oh, that's
the
right.
The timing never worked out.
I know. This is such a better... I was not as good about watching Gilmore Girls, so this is like very fun because I love...
Well, and it's such an easier ask, too. It's like, there's eight total.
Yes, yes.
You really don't have
And
to.
It has to do with your life and experiences specifically, so.
This is true.
It's terrific. Guys, thanks for joining us on Maisel Goys. We'll be back every Maisel Monday for the next 6 weeks. And let's go out the way they went out in this episode.
All right.
With a little Rebel Rebel.
Cover.
Yeah. Mm. Now, you know what? I sprung for the real one.
You did.
I paid all the rights.
You did. Oh, Kevin, I can't afford that.
No, I can.
Paid out of pocket.
Girl, we got that Squarespace money. No, we can do it. Thanks, everyone. Goodbye.
Bye.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.